The Production Expert Podcast is brought to you with the kind support of Autoria, Source Elements, and RSPE Audio Solutions.
Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast. I'm Damien Kearns, and in this edition, I'll be talking with Justin Webster of The Cargo Cult. His company is responsible for vital production tools like Matchbox, Slapper, Spanner, and his latest release, the incredible NV2. What I'm aiming to do in this episode is find out more about the person behind these industry-leading, paradigm-shifting software offerings. Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast, Justin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's been my dream to host one of these by myself, so I get the first one this time, and it's with you. So I'm really excited because I've always wanted to get to know you a little bit better and find out a little bit more about you and how your company evolved, because I've been a fan of the products for so long. You've had sort of an interesting career arc, haven't you? You've gone from a sort of engineer to audio engineer to software engineer. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into the business in the first place?
So I started when I was much younger playing music and studied audio engineering, you know, on the music side, and spent some time in London working in music studios, you know, with recording pop music and assisting on sessions and recording voiceover for adverts and that sort of thing. And so there's a couple of years really worth of that stuff before I ever really turned my focus to post-production proper.
So you were on, were you on sort of mid-sized dates, big dates, sort of, or running the sort of spectrum, you know, big and small recording dates?
So I was working in a couple of studios in London, one called H2O, which was a small ISDN type studio. We did a lot of ISDN sessions for post-production purposes. So we'd hook up with Chicago or New York and do a session with an artist that was in London. And then we were sort of absorbed into another studio, which some users might know, Sphere, which now moved to LA. So I worked there for a while as well. We had some big artists come through, and if you're lucky enough to assist on one of those sessions, it's a bit of fun. But I eventually had to move back to New Zealand, and when I did so, I sort of arrived in the middle of that Lord of the Rings period.
So you came back, you wanted to come back, or you felt compelled to come back? Did you miss home?
Yeah, a little. I mean, there were visa complications as well. We can, as Kiwis are allowed to, we can do it. I think Canadians are the same. We can do a couple of years in the UK before we're expected to leave. And so we did.
So the time was right.
The time was right, and there was a burgeoning film industry kicking off in Wellington, my hometown. So, it was a stroke of luck, I guess.
So, is it, you know, before we get right into the sort of arc that you know, of the Lord of the Rings stuff, is it fair to say that Peter Jackson has done monumental things for the New Zealand industry at this point?
Yeah, that would be absolutely fair to say.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable what he's done, and the fact that he insisted on doing it here in Wellington is even more remarkable. Everybody working in the film industry in New Zealand has to really thank Peter for the achievements and the facilities that he's built. The place that I normally work out of, Park Road Post, is an absolutely world-class studio, and just to have it on our doorstep is remarkable.
Wow. So how did you get into this particular production, the Lord of the Rings trilogy?
So I knew a couple of people working on it, Martin Kwok in particular, who's I still work with often, and eventually got a call to come down and work as an assistant on the Two Towers, the DVD, the extended version of the Two Towers, and then the Return of the King, and most of the major productions that have come through Wellington since, I've sort of been involved with in some way or another.
And what would you say your title or your job description was in that production?
Yeah, so I started as a dialogue assistant and moved into an effects assistant kind of a role. So I'd be doing a lot of, especially on those big shows like Rings, lots of effects recordings, recording impulse responses from underground tunnels, a lot of trips to the zoo and these sort of things.
Yeah, the fun stuff. Like that stuff
really is
all baked into the DVD box sets and everything, because I've watched all the extended cuts and all the DVD extras. So it's kind of fun to watch you guys make the noises for, dragons and things like that, how you got the sounds.
It's a huge privilege on those big jobs to be able to go and do that stuff, because the smaller films never have the budget to do that. You're expected to just use a library. So, if you check out, I think it's the King Kong box set, you might see me getting mud splashed in my face from a giant log or something. Yeah.
Well, it's the occupational hazard. At least it's only mud, right? So you worked at that, obviously, for a few years, right? Because there was some time, even though Jackson managed to keep production schedules fairly tight, from what I understand, it's still a fairly big chunk of time you were on that. Yeah, so you were on that for years. And during that period of time, is this where you started to transition to think about software engineering? I mean, I guess I'm a bit hazy as to how one goes from some of the biggest productions ever, to designing and conceptualizing pieces of software.
Yeah, so I've always tinkered around with software and websites and things, even when I was working in the music studios. So I guess it was at the end of the Lord of the Rings period. One of the really big challenges on those films was the constant recutting of the film while we were trying to put together the soundtrack. And there were actually three tools that came out of that period by three different software developers, myself, John Mackay, and Mark Franken. And the reason for that is just the scale of the recuts and the constant ongoing nature of it. So these tools were sort of designed to find a way to manage it and keep the soundtrack on track while this constant change was happening.
Yeah, so we're talking about reconform tools, the ability to take something from one picture edit and slide it in sync to another picture edit. And you guys were probably started off in the production doing it manually, but then figured out we've got to basically retool old concepts using edit decision lists and somehow automate it, for our present need. So it's, I think those three pieces of software, they were all pretty vital for you. And actually one of them I turned around and used in broadcast to work on overnight edits for semi-live shows. I remember talking to John Mackay, and he was, when I wrote to him and said that was what I was doing, he said, could you put that in an EDL, can you put that in an email? I'd like to actually read that and take it around and tell other people that these things can be used in broadcast.
Achoria has a wide selection of software effects, including 3 compressors, 3 filters, 3 preamps, and 3 delays you'll actually use. The latest release, 3 delays you'll actually use, includes Delay Tape 201, Delay Memory Brigade, and the unique and experimental Delay Eternity. A bundle of selected effects, called the AudioFuse Creative Suite, is included with all AudioFuse audio interfaces. Visit Achoria.com to find out more on the effects you'll actually use.
You record production audio in sync with timecode. It's then put into a system and then edited down, and I'll reconform it later based on this guide track edit. And it really did make things, that software that you guys all developed was paradigm shifting for the rest of the world, I believe.
Yeah, and since, I guess that production was probably you know, at the vanguard of chaotic reconforming. I'm sorry, I've got an earthquake happening right now.
Seriously?
Yeah, monitors shaking all over the place.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's the first time we've had one for a while.
You get
them. Looks like we're good.
You get them infrequently or often down there?
I guess you'd say frequently, but it's been quite a while since I noticed one.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, what was the question?
I think we were just we were just on about conforming and how it was paradigm shifting around the world. It really did change the nature of workflows.
Oh, yeah.
Because
right.
Suddenly we were able to, I think, you know, suddenly with all this software, we're now able to, around the world, we're able to fix sync between edits in minutes where it used to take hours, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the reason I think that three independent products came out of that Lord of the Rings phase was that it was sort of, that show was sort of the vanguard when it came to massive and ongoing recutting. But since then, the idea of picture lock has completely gone out the window. So everyone has the same problem. Visual effects have made that even worse. Pretty much, you know, even very small shows have a lot of visual effects that can change right up to the final mix or even after. So it sort of became a problem for everybody at some point after Rings.
Yeah, it's. I don't think Rings was the initiator of the problem, though. I think Rings reflected the fact that the technology allowed us to make changes at a much quicker pace than we were doing prior on tape and cheaper, too.
Picture editing moving to nonlinear editors as well. I mean, that's the real reason this is. That's the real reason that we now chase cuts so frequently is that the picture department can recut so easily.
Yeah. So when you finished that project, you moved on to other ones. I guess at what period in your life did Cargo Cult come about for you?
So I guess I just drifted slowly into that. Initially, we were called Maggot and just had that one product, Conformalizer.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that very much started just as a hobby, as a side project. I saw a need. I wanted to build a tool that solved that problem and very slowly started to sell it. So that was over probably the first 5, 6, 7 years of the company was just very slowly providing that tool to anyone who asked. It was, I think, maybe about 10 years ago that we sort of stepped into plugins. So that was Spanner. It was right at the start of The Hobbit. So I spent about 4 years working on that Hobbit project. And right before that started, I was messing around with this panning surround channel management kind of idea, which became Spanner, which is, you know, it's still a really popular tool used today, and you'll see it in a lot of surround mixing templates.
So Spanner is a tool that sort of came out of a perceived necessity, and I think the same can be said about Conformalizer. Do you think that your career has given you the kind of insight that allows you to kind of almost have precognition about what things might need in the future, or are you really reacting to the needs that you see at the time and thinking, you know what, I can make a tool that will solve that problem? I guess what I'm asking is, how do you conceptualize this stuff?
Yeah, and it always and definitely comes from my personal experience working in the job. That's where all of these ideas come from. And if you're doing a thing over and over every day, my mind at least immediately drifts into how can I make this faster? Why am I having to click this thing 5 times? Why can't I pan all of these objects at the same time? It seems crazy that I can't. So, you know, and I have a notebook which I keep on the desk, and when one of these ideas pops in my head, I'll scribble it down. And then at some point in the future, if I get an opportunity, maybe in between film jobs, I'll whip out the notebook and see if I can build one of these tools.
So that you just said something there that's kind of key, and I twigged on it. You're still doing film jobs to this day.
Yeah, that's right. The last couple of years, I've slowed down a bit. I've had, you know, some big projects like Matchbox and Envy, which have really kept me on the working inside Xcode rather than Pro Tools. But yeah, I've got a film job booked for, which was supposed to start this month, but it sounds like it might start in December. Yeah, and I think it's really important that I keep myself in the game and keep working on these shows. Otherwise, I'm not going to understand where the industry is going. I'm not going to have any further progress on these tools. And I'm going to maybe miss opportunities that I would have otherwise seen.
So you're basically saying to me that participation in the industry helps you keep your company afloat.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's something really special about the designer being the engineer, being the user. I think if you can have someone who is all three of those things, there's a huge advantage, not just in not just in conceptualizing and, you know, coming up with the ideas for the tools, but it means that the engineer, when you're wearing the engineer hat, you can cut certain corners because you know the user won't use certain features. And the designer can design in a way that makes it easy for the engineer. So if you try to be all three of those things, you can be a lot more efficient and get a much better product, I believe.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it does reflect in sometimes in the simplicity of your approach. Like I'm thinking of NV2 right now, which I love. It really is, you know, you had a product that started as a plugin in the first version, which was great. You realized, hey, you know, from a user standpoint, maybe I can make this a little less dependent on certain DAWs and make it a bit more agnostic, but also give it a little bit more flexibility and ease of use by, you know, by sort of developing the interface.
Yeah.
How long did that take you to kind of move from one version to the next?
Well, I spent most of this year working on it, so there's that.
Wow.
But the conceptualizing it, like the period leading up to that, trying to understand how I can get out of this plugin format, which was, you know, it was a little bit limiting. There's only so much you can do in an AAX plugin,
yeah.
apart from making it available to people in Reaper and Logic and so on. There's sort of physical limitations to the plugin format. So there's like a long process of trying to figure out where are we going to go with this, which is quite separate to the actual process of making it happen.
Well, the new version's outstanding. Like I find it, you know, I've told you this before privately, but I use NV2 every day for dialogue, you know, massaging inflections between Frank and edits.
Yeah.
And, you know, there, to my mind, I'll come out and say it, there's no better tool out there at the minute than NV2. It's not a shameless plug. It's actually what I believe. Let's talk a bit about your product line only in the fact that you've made these things and none of them really seem to reference the others in terms of each one is a standalone thought. It doesn't go, hey, I'm going to make Slapper and I'm going to have it talk to Envy and I'm going to, you know, throw a spanner in the works, if I can use that. Each one of these things kind of does a silo it does its own thing.
I think what you're saying is my tools are all completely inconsistent and
there's no
overarching thing.
You can almost see the mind at work here that each time you've had a problem, you've developed a tool. As we've sort of alluded to earlier, you've developed a tool to fix the problem. And over time, you might release updates and refine it, but the tool is to help you work better in what you do, save time and get a better product out.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm wondering with the range of tools you have, do you have a favorite?
No. I mean, I guess at any given moment, the one I've most recently released might be considered a favorite, but they're also completely different because they're designed, you know, to solve a specific set of problems. Or so you can see, even from the interfaces, there's very little consistency. Each one is designed for a specific goal and barely references any of the others.
But I love that about these things. You know, each one is an entity unto itself, right? And that's I think that's what makes the Cargo Cult so unique, whereas some other companies tend to build off of the same devices each time. Yours said, no, I'm going to make something new for a new thing that I want to do. So it's creativity with purposeful creativity, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, any effort I was to put into, you know, like a unified look, that would be just taking away from my efforts to try and optimize that particular interface. So Slapper looks the way it does because I'm trying to present it to look like it sounds, for example. So if I was to try and standardize the appearance, then you take away some of the ergonomic benefits that we've otherwise tried to put in.
The Production Expert Podcast is made possible using Source Connect Now from Source Elements, the free way to record high-quality audio over the internet. Need to record an interview or a podcast like this one remotely? With Source Connect Now, you can. Using a Chrome browser, you'll get ISDN-equivalent quality audio without the need to install any additional software. Register for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way of thinking, conceptualizing of your creations. I'm wondering, let's move the topic just slightly. What is your view on the current zeitgeist of software subscriptions? How do you feel about subscription-based models for your software?
Yeah. So I don't have a problem with subscriptions. We all pay for Spotify and Netflix, and everyone seems to be comfortable with that. So I don't see why there should be any pushback when it comes to audio plugins or DAWs. It's probably just people fearing change or not wanting to switch the model that they've currently got. So the Cargo Cult doesn't currently offer any products on subscription, and there are a number of reasons, not because of any general opposition to subscriptions. There's just some financial reasons with doing cross-border sales of software licenses, and there's a fair amount of complication in building, you know, like web store infrastructure, recurrent payments and that sort of stuff. It ends up becoming quite expensive for us as the developer. And there's a trade-off as to whether those expenses will be outweighed by benefits from subscriptions. So really just practical reasons rather than any objection to subscriptions per se.
Oh, yeah. So it's not philosophical. It's really
not at all
financial and logistical. You know, it's, do I really want to spend, you know, weeks or months putting, you know, that infrastructure in, and do I gain anything from it? Yeah. No, I get that. I think the subscription model, it does have practical implications to some of the broadcasters or studios I've worked at, where the audio budget is reviewed maybe annually for purchasing. You know, so you basically, you don't have a monthly stipend that your department is allowed. So there may be practical reasons why some larger places may opt for the purchase. It may be a tax benefit a certain year, but other than that, it's, I think the subscription model, what it does allow for the companies that do it is, you know, steady income. Right? That's why they want to do it. Let's move from that to software piracy. Do you find the Cargo Cult's software coming up in places where it shouldn't be, or have you managed to evade that so far?
Do I really want to answer that question? Of course, I'm completely opposed to software piracy. I can't claim to be completely benevolent in my younger days. I think the climate has changed, though. I think piracy is definitely frowned upon a lot more. And it's, I think people realize that if they go downloading a crack of a plugin, they're probably inheriting some other nasty little virus or malware of some kind. I don't know. I don't hang out in young music producer circles, so I don't know whether people are still passing around huge collections of cracked plugins, but
it's not just the music producers either. It's sorry to interrupt, but it, you know, it's I've seen it in post-production where people have underground connections and take these things and put them in with varying degrees of success. But you know, I guess I'm wondering more, has it affected your business at all? Do you think it's affected your business at all?
I don't think so. No, because we more or less focus on surround mixing, post-production, sound design. And in those circles, I think probably people are a bit more inclined to just buy the tools they need or have the studio buy the tools that they need. So if we have been affected by piracy, it's to a small extent.
Yeah, or so negligible that you're not even aware of it. You and I have talked a couple of times or emailed a couple of times over the years. And when you do a launch, I just want to change topics because I'm really interested in this personally. You do a launch, it seems like your feedback from your customers is pretty instantaneous when you launch your software. Would you say that when you launch a new piece software, you find that there's an overwhelming response, or do you have to bring on extra people? I guess I don't know much about that side of things, especially when you know you're a small company. How do you deal with a launch?
I'm not sure whether it's normal or I have nothing to compare it to, but I know what you mean. There can be a lot of really exciting feedback on social media over those first few days. But like you say, we're a small company with a pretty contained audience, being mostly post-production. So, and we don't get overwhelmed with feedback, unless we have a bug, of course, or something along those lines to deal with. But we obviously try to minimize that as much as possible.
Yes. And speaking of that, how's NV2 coming along in terms of feedback? You've just released it a week or so ago. And, I know my feedback's positive. But have you had anything that's made you rethink anything about the UI or any ideas for the future?
Yeah, I'd like to tear it up and start again, to be honest. But that's always the case when I get to release day and decide that today's the day I have to stop messing with it.
Yeah,
It's also the point where I've got plans for how to make version 3 amazing. Yeah. So that's been really good. Been really positive feedback. There were a couple of small bugs we fixed with sample rates that corrupt sometimes. There's been like little issues like the way people want to output audio from the thing. It seems like maybe Rewire might be a good idea for the next point update to give people an option to output audio direct into a Pro Tools track, for example. So yeah, these sort of things go to the top of the to-do list once we hear back from users on the first couple of days.
Yeah, I can put my hand up and say Source Nexus, would be... If you could implement a way to route through that, you wouldn't even need Rewire, right?
Right. I'm writing that down.
Or you know, it's definitely one way, because you could then use Nexus to go through any set of speakers or into any interface, as long as people have the control panel set properly.
Yeah, that may even work at the moment, I think. Anything that presents itself as a hardware audio I/O, you can use.
No, what I like about it is there are choices, whereas with other software there isn't. There's a vanilla or there's a chocolate, and that's it. Those are the flavors you get. Yours, there's a wider range of options for the I/O, which is important, I think.
RSPE Audio Solutions design, sell, and install professional audio and video equipment. Their team are available by phone, live chat, or email to receive and process orders. They have everything you need to build or upgrade your home studio to ensure you can continue to work from home. If there is anything they can do to help, reach out or shop online at rspeaudio.com.
All right, Justin. I'm going to ask you a question here, and I want a tantalizing answer. Is there anything you've got on the horizon that you'd like to talk about in terms of development that the listeners might sort of wake up and go, ooh, that's an interesting thing?
Oh, no, Damien, sorry. I don't actually have nothing.
All right.
I'm not going to do anything. I'm trying to take a break and focus on marketing and running the business. I've promised my family that I'm going to stop designing new things for the moment.
Yeah. Any updates for any kind of software? How is Atmos going to play into your product line?
Yeah. So we updated Slapper 2019. I think, with the 7.1.2 format, and added a few extra features like a small reverb tails and some really nice interface features. And it seems like the music industry has started to wake up to the incredible power that you can get for immersive mixing out of Slapper. So obviously music industry's been starting to remix everything in Dolby Atmos. So, yeah, we're starting to see a lot of people pick up Slapper specifically to help unwrap some of those old stereo recordings and turn them into big, immersive, room-filling, theatrical-type mixes.
Would you ever consider doing something for reverb like you've done with delay in terms of, focusing those sort of point sources and dealing it with reverb that way? I guess I'm curious. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I have an entry in my notebook for a reverb idea that I've been sitting on for years. Still not sure if I will ever do it. Partly because I think Slapper's drifted into that territory now.
Yeah.
It can be a very complex set of echoes. So you're already drifting into reverb territory, especially when there are lots of short echoes. And now we've now added like a little soft reverb tail on each of those taps. So you really can play it like a reverb. So, yeah, I'm not sure if we will ever do a specific Cargo Cult reverb, but you never know.
Well, I think at this point, I got to say thanks for all your time, Justin. Normally at the end of this podcast, we have what we like to do, a find of the week, which can be virtually anything. I'm just curious, do you have a find of the week that you could share with the listeners?
I absolutely adore the Freak Show Industries stuff, all of their stuff. In fact, I like their website as much as I like their plugins. So, yeah, Dumpster Fire, they do some really crazy stuff, and just adore their aesthetic and the way they present their tutorial videos, which don't really teach you much.
I'm going to have to check them out.
Yeah, do so.
I was going to say for mine, it's Source Nexus. Now, I've had it since the day it was released, I think, but utility is always the thing. I haven't had occasion to use it a lot because it's worked for the one thing I've been doing for it. But what I found out is it's got 24 buses, and I was able to make 5.1 buses and send stuff around and bus things internally. It's actually helped me get rid of two hardware interfaces. So I can't say enough about Source Nexus. And of course, I'm going to throw an extra one in there, Envy 2 by the Cargo Cult, because it really is my new favorite toy.
Excellent. That's what we like to hear.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
And yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.